This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Anthroposophy in Everyday Life. This is the fourth and last lecture in this small booklet. It's entitled The Four Temperaments, given in Berlin, March 4th, 1909. It has frequently been emphasized that humanity's greatest riddle is itself. Both natural and spiritual science ultimately try to solve this riddle, the former by understanding the natural laws that govern our outer being, the latter by seeking the essence and purpose inherent in our existence. Now, as correct as it may be that humanity's greatest riddle is itself, it must also be emphasized that each individual human being is a riddle, often even to itself. Every one of us experiences this in encounters with other people. Today we shall be dealing not with general riddles, but rather with those posed to us by every human being in every encounter, and these are just as important. For how endlessly varied people are. We need only consider temperament, the subject of today's lecture, in order to realize that there are as many riddles as there are people. Even within the basic types known as the temperaments, such variety exists among people that the very mystery of existence seems to express itself within these types. Temperament, that fundamental coloring of the human personality, plays a role in all manifestations of individuality that are of concern to practical life. We sense something of this basic mood whenever we encounter another human being. Thus, we can only hope that spiritual science will tell us what we need to know about the temperaments. Our first impression of the temperaments is that they are external, for although they can be said to flow from within, they manifest themselves in everything we can observe from without. However, this does not mean that the human riddle can be solved by means of natural science and observation. Only when we hear what spiritual science has to say can we come closer to understanding these peculiar colorations of the human personality. Spiritual science tells us, first of all, that the human being is part of a line of heredity. A person displays the characteristics that were inherited from father, mother, grandparents, and so on. These characteristics are then passed on to the following progeny. The human being thus possesses certain traits by virtue of being part of a succession of generations. However, this inheritance gives us only one side of human nature. Joined to that is the individuality that is brought out of the spiritual world. This is added to what father, mother, and other ancestors are able to give. Something that proceeds from life to life, from existence to existence, connects itself with the generational stream. Certain characteristics can be attributed to heredity. On the other hand, as a person develops from childhood on, we can see unfolding out of the center of this being something that must be the fruit of preceding lives, something that could never have been only inherited from ancestors. We come to know the law of reincarnation, of the succession of earthly lives, and this is but a special case of an all-encompassing cosmic law. An illustration will make this seem less paradoxical. Consider a lifeless mineral, say a rock crystal. Should the crystal be destroyed, it leaves nothing of its form that could be passed on to other crystals. A new crystal receives nothing of the old one's particular form. Footnote, translator's note. The reader may conclude from this remark, for it was, after all, a remark, not a published claim, that Steiner was ignorant of the concept of seed crystals. However, a likelier explanation is that Steiner, whose audience was very likely not a scientifically knowledgeable one, was simply indulging in a bit of rhetorical hyperbole. He doubtless knew that a seed crystal will hasten the crystallization process in a saturated salt solution. But this fact is not really relevant to his point. which comes out only gradually in this paragraph. His point is not that a newly formed crystal cannot receive some contribution from a previously existing one, only that it need not. This is in contrast to living things, which require a progenitor. End of translator's footnote. When we move on to the world of plants, we notice that a plant cannot develop according to the same laws as the crystal. It can only originate from another earlier plant. Form is here preserved and passed on. Moving on to the animal kingdom, we find an evolution of the species taking place. We begin to appreciate why the 19th century held the discovery of evolution to be its greatest achievement. In animals, not only does one being proceed from another, but each young animal during the embryo phase recapitulates the earlier phases of its species' evolutionary development. The species itself undergoes an enhancement. In human beings, not only does the species evolve, but so does the individual. What a human being acquires in a lifetime through education and experience is preserved, just as surely as are the evolutionary achievements of an animal's ancestral line. It will someday be commonplace to trace a person's inner core to a previous existence. The human being will come to know as the product of an earlier life. The human being will come to be known as the product of an earlier life. The views that stand in the way of this doctrine will be overcome, just as was the scholarly opinion of an earlier century, which held that living organisms could arise from non-living substances. As recently as 300 years ago, scholars believed that animals could evolve from river mud, that is, from non-living matter. Francesco Redi, an Italian scientist, was the first to assert that living things could develop only from other living things. Footnote: Francesco Redi, 1626 to 1697, refuted spontaneous generation of living beings out of mud. End of footnote. For this he was attacked and came close to suffering the fate of Giordano Bruno. Footnote: Giordano Bruno, 1548 to 1600, Italian philosopher, Dominican monk, burned at the stake as heretic, taught that the world is infinite in space and time and filled with innumerable suns. End of footnote. Today, burning people at the stake is no longer fashionable. When someone attempts to teach a new truth, for example, that psycho-spiritual entities must be traced back to earlier psycho-spiritual entities, that person won't exactly be burned at the stake, but will probably be dismissed as a fool. But the time will come when the real foolishness will be to believe that the human being lives only once, that there is no enduring entity that unites itself with a person's inherited traits. Now the important question arises: how can something originating in a completely different world, that must seek a father and a mother, unite itself with physical corporeality? How can it clothe itself in the bodily features that link human beings to an hereditary chain? How does the spiritual psychic stream of which a human being forms a part through reincarnation unite itself with the physical stream of heredity? The answer is that a synthesis must be achieved. When the two streams combine, each imparts something of its own quality to the other. In much the same way that blue and yellow combine to give green, the two streams in the human being combined to yield what is commonly known as temperament. Our inner self and our inherited traits both appear in it. Temperament stands between the things that connect a human being to an ancestral line and those the human being brings out of earlier incarnations. Temperament strikes a balance between the eternal and the ephemeral. And it does so in such a way that the essential members of the human being, which we have come to know in other contexts, enter into a very specific relationship with one another. Human beings, as we know them, in this life, are beings of four members. The first, the physical body, they have in common with the mineral world. The first supersensible member, the etheric body, is integrated into the physical and separates from it only at death. There follows as third member the astral body, the bearer of instincts, drives, passions, desires, and of the ever-changing content of sensation and thought. Our highest member places us above all other earthly beings as the bearer of the human ego, which endows us in such a curious and yet undeniable fashion with the power of self-awareness. These four members we have come to know as the essential constituents of a human being. The way the four members combine is determined by the flowing together of the two streams upon a person's entry into the physical world. In every case, one of the four members achieves predominance over the others and gives them its own peculiar stamp. Where the bearer of the ego predominates, a choleric temperament results. Where the astral body predominates, we find a sanguine temperament. Where the etheric or life body predominates, we speak of a phlegmatic temperament. And where the physical body predominates, we have to deal with a melancholic temperament. The specific way in which the eternal and the ephemeral combine determines what relationship the four members will enter into with one another. The way the four members find their expression in the physical body has also frequently been mentioned. The ego expresses itself in the circulation of the blood. For this reason, in the choleric, the predominant system is that of the blood. The astral body expresses itself physically in the nervous system. Thus, in the sanguine, the nervous system holds sway. The etheric body expresses itself in the glandular system. Hence, the phlegmatic is dominated physically by the glands. The physical body, as such, expresses itself only in itself. Thus, the outwardly most important feature in the melancholic is the physical body. This can be observed in all phenomena connected with these temperaments. In the choleric, the ego and the blood system predominate. Cholerics come across as people who must always have their own way. Their aggressiveness, everything connected with their forcefulness of will, derives from their blood circulation. In the nervous system and astral body, sensations and feelings constantly fluctuate. Any harmony or order results solely from the restraining influence of the ego. People who do not exercise that influence appear to have no control over their thoughts and sensations. They are totally absorbed by the sensations, pictures, and ideas that ebb and flow within them. Something like this occurs whenever the astral body predominates, as for example in the sanguine. Sanguines surrender themselves in a certain sense to the constant and varied flow of images, sensations, and ideas, since in them the astral body and nervous system predominate. The nervous system's activity is restrained only by the circulation of the blood. That this is so becomes clear when we consider what happens when a person lacks blood or is anemic, in other words, when the blood's restraining influence is absent. Mental images fluctuate wildly, often leading to illusions and hallucinations. A touch of this is present in sanguines. Sanguines are incapable of lingering over an impression. They cannot fix their attention on a particular image, nor sustain their interest in an impression. Instead, they rush from experience to experience, from percept to percept. This is especially noticeable in sanguine children, where it can be a source of concern. The sanguine child's interest is easily kindled. A picture will easily impress, but the impression quickly vanishes. We proceed now to the phlegmatic temperament. We observed that this temperament develops when the etheric or life body, as we call it, which regulates growth and metabolism, is predominant. The result is a sense of inner well-being. The more human beings live in their etheric body, the more they are preoccupied with their own internal processes. They let external events run their course, while their attention is directed inward. In Melancholics, we have seen that the physical body, the coarsest member of the human organization, becomes master over the others. As a result, melancholics feel they are not master over their body, that they cannot bend it to their will. The physical body, which is intended to be an instrument of the higher members, is itself in control and frustrates the others. Melancholics experience this as pain, as a feeling of despondency. Pain continually wells up within them because the physical body resists the etheric body's inner sense of well-being, the astral body's liveliness, and the ego's purposeful striving. The varying combinations of the four members also manifest themselves quite clearly in external appearance. People in whom the ego predominates seek to triumph over all obstacles, to make their presence known. Accordingly, their ego stunts the growth of the other members. It withholds from the astral and etheric bodies their due portion. This reveals itself outwardly in a very clear fashion. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, that famous German choleric, was recognizable as such purely externally. Footnote: Johann Gottlieb Fichte, 1762 to 1814, German idealist philosopher. End of footnote. His build revealed clearly that the lower essential members had been held back in their growth. Napoleon, another classic example of the choleric, was so short because his ego had held the other members back. Footnote: Napoleon Bonaparte, 1769 to 1821, French ruler and emperor, 1804 to 1814 and 1815. End of footnote. Of course, one cannot generalize that all cholerics are short and all sanguines tall. It is a question of proportion. What matters is the relation of size to overall form. In the sanguine, the nervous system and the astral body predominate. The astral body's inner liveliness animates the other members and makes the external form as mobile as possible. Whereas the choleric has sharply chiseled facial features, the sanguines are mobile, expressive, changeable. We see the astral body's inner liveliness manifested in every outer detail, for example, in a slender form, a delicate bone structure, or lean muscles. The same thing can be observed in details of behavior. Even a non-clairvoyant can tell from behind whether someone is a choleric or a sanguine. One does not need to be a spiritual scientist for that. If you observe the gait of a choleric, you will notice that a choleric plants each foot so solidly that it would seem to bore down into the ground. By contrast, the sanguine has a light, springy step. Even subtler external traits can be found. The inwardness of the ego, the choleric's self-contained inwardness, expresses itself in eyes that are dark and smoldering. The sanguine, whose ego has not taken such deep root, who is filled with the liveliness of his astral body, tends by contrast to have blue eyes. Many more such distinctive traits of these temperaments could be cited. The phlegmatic temperament manifests itself in a static, indifferent physiognomy, as well as in plumpness, for fat is due largely to the activity of the etheric body. In all this, the phlegmatic's inner sense of comfort is expressed. The gait is loose-jointed and shambling, and the manner timid. Phlegmatics seem somehow to be not entirely in touch with their surroundings. The melancholic is distinguished by a hanging head, as if the strength necessary to straighten the neck was lacking. The eyes are dull, not shining like the choleric's. The gait is firm, but in a leaden way, rather than a resolute sort of way. Thus you see how significantly spiritual science can contribute to the solution of this riddle. Only when one seeks to encompass reality in its entirety, which includes the spiritual, can knowledge bear practical fruit. Accordingly, only spiritual science can give us knowledge that will benefit the individual and all humankind. In education, very close attention must be paid to the individual temperaments, for it is especially important to be able to guide and direct them as they develop in the child. But the temperaments are also important to our efforts to improve ourselves later in life. We do well to attend to what expresses itself through them if we wish to further our personal development. The four fundamental types I have outlined here for you naturally never manifest themselves in such pure form. Every human being has one basic temperament, with varying degrees of the other three mixed in. Napoleon, for example, although a choleric, had much of the phlegmatic in him. To truly master life, it is important that we open our souls to what manifests itself as typical. When we consider that the temperaments, each of which represents a mild imbalance, can degenerate into unhealthy extremes, we realize just how important this is. Yet without the temperaments, the world would be an exceedingly dull place, not only ethically, but also in a higher sense. The temperaments alone make all multiplicity, beauty, and fullness of life possible. Thus, in education, it would be senseless to want to homogenize or eliminate them. But an effort should be made to direct each into the proper track. For in every temperament there lie two dangers of aberration, one great, one small. One danger for young cholerics is that they will never learn to control their temper as they develop into maturity. That is the small danger. The greater is that they will become foolishly single-minded. For the sanguine, the lesser danger is flightiness. The greater is mania, induced by a constant stream of sensations. The small danger for the phlegmatic is apathy. The greater is stupidity, dullness. For the melancholic, insensitivity to anything other than personal pain is the small danger. The greater is insanity. In light of all this, it is clear that to guide the temperaments is one of life's significant tasks. If this task is to be properly carried out, however, one basic principle must be observed, which is always to reckon with what is given, and not with what is not there. For example, if a child has a sanguine temperament, it will not be helped by elders who try to flog interest into the child. The temperament simply will not allow it. Instead of asking what the child lacks, in order that we might beat it in, we must focus on what the child has and base ourselves on that. And as a rule, there is one thing that will always stimulate the sanguine child's interest. However flighty the child might be, we can always stimulate interest in a particular personality. If we ourselves are that personality, or if we bring the child together with someone who is, the child cannot but develop an interest. Only through the medium of love for a personality can the interest of the sanguine child be awakened. More than children of any other temperament, the sanguine needs someone to admire. Admiration is here a kind of magic word, and we must do everything we can to awaken it. We must reckon with what we have. We should see to it that the sanguine child is exposed to a variety of things in which a deeper interest is shown. These things should be allowed to speak to the child, to have an effect upon the child. They should then be withdrawn, so that the child's interest in them will intensify. Then they may be restored. In other words, we must fashion the sanguine's environment so that it is in keeping with the temperament. The choleric child is also susceptible of being led in a special way. The key to this child's education is respect and esteem for a natural authority. Instead of winning affection by means of personal qualities, as we try to do with the sanguine child, we should see to it that the child's belief in the teacher's ability remains unshaken. The teacher must demonstrate an understanding of what goes on around the child. Any showing of incompetence should be avoided. The child must persist in the belief that the teacher is competent or all authority will be lost. The magic potion for the choleric child is respect and esteem for a person's worth, just as for the sanguine child, it is love for a personality. Outwardly, the choleric child must be confronted with challenging situations. The choleric must encounter resistance and difficulty, lest life become too easy. The melancholic child is not easy to lead. With a melancholic, however, a different approach may be applied. For the sanguine child, the approach is love for a personality. For the choleric, it is respect and esteem for a teacher's worth. By contrast, the important thing for the melancholic is that the teachers be people who have, in a certain sense, been tried by life, who act and speak on the basis of past trials. The child must feel that the teacher has known real pain. Let your treatment of life's details be an occasion for the child to appreciate what you have suffered. Sympathy with the destinies of others furthers the melancholic's development. Here, too, one must reckon with what the child has. The melancholic has a firmly rooted capacity for suffering, for discomfort, that cannot be disciplined out. However, it can be redirected. We should expose the child to legitimate external pain and suffering, so that the child learns there are outer things that can engage the capacity for experiencing pain. This is the essential thing. We should not try to divert or amuse the melancholic, for to do so only intensifies the despondency and inner suffering. Instead, the melancholic child must be enabled to see that objective occasions for suffering exist in life. Although we must not carry it too far, redirecting the child's suffering to outside objects is what is called for. The phlegmatic child should not be allowed to grow up alone, although naturally all children should have playmates. For phlegmatics, it is especially important that they have them. Their playmates should have the most varied interests. Phlegmatic children learn by sharing in the interests, the more numerous, the better, of others. Their playmates' enthusiasms will overcome their native indifference toward the world. Whereas the important thing for the melancholic is to experience another person's destiny, for the phlegmatic child it is to experience the whole range of a playmate's interests. The phlegmatic is not moved by things as such, but an interest arises when he sees things reflected in others, and these interests are then reflected in the soul of the phlegmatic child. We should bring into the phlegmatic's environment objects and events toward which phlegm is an important reaction. Impassivity must be directed toward the right objects, objects toward which one may be phlegmatic. From the examples of these pedagogical principles, we see how spiritual science can address practical problems. These principles can also be applied to oneself for purposes of self-improvement. For example, a sanguine gains little by self-reproach. Our minds are in such questions frequently an obstacle. When pitted directly against stronger forces, such as the temperaments, they can accomplish little. Indirectly, however, they can accomplish much. Sanguines, for example, can take their sanguinity into account, abandoning self-exhortation as fruitless. The important thing is to display sanguinity under the right circumstances. Experiences suited to a short attention span can be brought about through thoughtful planning. Using thought in this way, even on the smallest scale, will produce the requisite effect. Persons of a choleric temperament should purposely not themselves, persons of a choleric temperament should purposely put themselves in situations where rage is of no use, but rather only makes them look ridiculous. Melancholics should not close their eyes to life's pain, but rather seek it out. Through compassion, they redirect their suffering outward toward appropriate objects and events. If we are phlegmatics, having no particular interests, then we should occupy ourselves as much as possible with uninteresting things, surround ourselves with numerous sources of tedium, so that we become thoroughly bored. We will then be thoroughly cured of our phlegm. We will have gotten it out of our system. Thus does one reckon with what one has, and not with what one does not have. By filling ourselves with practical wisdom such as this, we learn to solve that basic riddle of life, the other person. It is solved not by postulating abstract ideas and concepts, but by means of pictures. Instead of arbitrarily theorizing, we should seek an immediate understanding of every individual human being. We can do this, however, only by knowing what lies in the depths of the soul. Slowly and gradually, spiritual science illuminates our minds, making us receptive not only to the big picture, but also to subtle details. Spiritual science makes it possible that when two souls meet and one demands love, the other offers it. If something else is demanded, that other thing is given. Through such true living wisdom do we create the basis for society. This is what we mean when we say we must solve a riddle every moment. Anthroposophy acts not by means of sermons, exhortations, or catechisms, but by creating a social groundwork upon which human beings can come to know each other. Spiritual science is the ground of life, and love is the blossom and fruit of a life enhanced by it. Thus spiritual science may claim to lay the foundation for the human being's most beautiful goal, a true, genuine love for humankind. End of the lecture, The Four Temperaments. This is a small booklet by the Anthroposophic Press called Anthroposophy in Everyday Life.